everybody, my name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. I really appreciate being invited down, breaking with format a little bit here, and being asked to share some of my experience, strength, and hope, and history. I had a little bit to do with the forming of this society. I suppose I can be considered a co-founder. A lot of the ideas came out of a basic need that I and some other people saw in the community for something like this. And although I've not been really involved in the formation, I was there in the very beginning. Some people like Ray, T, Jimmy, have been really, really active and involved in forming this fellowship, and being very, very generous with their time as far as taking other people through the steps, providing them with a spiritual awakening, and then sending them out to do the same with other people. There was a real need and is a real need for what A&A does, and I'm very, very proud to be asked to participate in it. I'm going to tell a little bit of my story, but more than that, I want to talk about why there's a need for something like A&A. When you have NA and you have AA out there, what do we need one more fellowship for? Well, there's some very good reasons, and it comes out of my experience, out of some other people's experience who were influential in the formation of the society. Basically, I'm an alcoholic. I'm one of those tongue-chewing, knee-walking, coming after you, car-sleeping, calling up Mary Lou McGillicuddy from third grade on the phone in a blackout type of drunk, you know? I mean, I was just really pathetic. By about 8 o'clock at night, I would just be in a delirious blackout, staggering around the house, you know, wondering where all the babes were, you know. I mean, I was a mess. I did a lot of drugs in my day, mountains of them. And there were periods of time in my life where they were a real issue. There was a heroin period. There was a cocaine period. There certainly was a Xanax and prescription tranquilizing period. That was fun. You know, try pronouncing five-syllable words when you're doing handfuls of Xanax. There was a period of time when I smoked more dope than Jerry Garcia back in the 70s, and that really destroyed a lot of my short-term memory, so I can't remember names. I even went to one of those Dale Carmichael memory courses, but it didn't work. The drugs were an issue, but something always happened with them. I always, with the pot, I kept smoking until I became paranoid and decided I wasn't going to smoke pot anymore, and I didn't. Cocaine, it got to the point, well, one time when I bought... I bought a quarter ounce for a party, and nobody showed. And if anybody in here knows what it's like to try to decide to save some for tomorrow when you're snorting some coke, well, I ended up snorting coke for 3 days straight, chirping like a squirrel. My jaws were locked like this. You know, the FBI and the CIA were after me, which was kind of unusual. Why would they be spending all that money on overtime for somebody like me? But they were out there, and so I kind of decided that maybe cocaine wasn't the thing for me, and I was able to move away from it without too great difficulty. I started to use heroin to control my drinking. If you're new or just coming back, I'm not recommending that, as heroin is not a good form of sobriety. What happened was it got really bad with the heroin. certain rules and morals and ethical codes of behavior seem to become less and less important, you know, when you're on heroin. And this one day, I did too much of it coming back from New York City because I was drunk as a goat and decided, I talked a friend of mine into going into town and getting some dope. And I did too much on the way back, and I went out. And I woke up on this guy's garage floor in the middle of winter, and he's throwing buckets of cold water on me. And I was mad. I don't like buckets of cold water being thrown on me, just in case you don't know. He's saying, man, you went out. I thought that you were going to die. I was trying to revive you. I go, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die. Don't throw cold water on me. What's the matter with you? So I got the impression that with the way I was drinking alcohol, it was probably a bad idea to have heroin around. I'd do a Jimi Hendrix, you know, or something like that, without even knowing it. So I was able to back away from that by using Xanax and alcohol to wean myself off of the heroin. One day on the Xanax, it used to big thing on the pill bottle. It used to say no alcohol on the Xanax bottle. And I would pour them out of my hand. I wouldn't even count them. I'd just weigh them, you know. Okay, I've got a, you know, quarter ounce of Xanax here. Oh, and then I'd chug it back with some vodka, which, you know, that big letters, no alcohol, that was certainly not for one of my caliber. I've got a tolerance to this stuff. And then I would destroy the furniture in the house for about 4 or 5 hours until I finally passed out. But this one day, I allowed myself to be over-medicated. Has that ever happened to anyone in here?
No.
You ever allow yourself to be over-served or over-medicated? It's rough. And I took way too many Xanax, and I drank way too much booze. And I'm one of these guys who goes to work the next day. You know what I'm saying? I make it to work. Because that's like the last thing I'm hanging on to, is being able to make it to work. So this guy picks me up for work, and he takes one look at me and he says, Chris, man, you better just go home. You are not in any shape to work. What do you mean? I'm going to work. And I'll never forget, the parking lot's way down, you know, the place where you got to park your car is way down at the end of the lot, and you have to walk up the lot to the shop where the boss would hand out the job assignments. And he's sitting there in front of a big window, and he turns and he looks, and I'm walking serpentine up to the shop. I can't even walk straight to the shop. I'm back and forth like this. He starts, God, damn it. You know, and he yells at me and he humiliates me in front of my peers, which I just hate. You know, being made fun of in front of my peers was just the as low as I could go. And I decided that I better get off of these Xanax. And I was able to drink my way off of those Xanax. I just had to increase my vodka and bourbon dosages. Alcohol, you know, I had lost a lot of things drinking. I lost a family. You know, I married this wonderful codependent. Anybody in here, you try to find somebody that thinks about you more than you do. And that's a perfect fit. That's what I did. I found the one who loved me more than I did. And we hooked up. She was a Catholic, so the night of our wedding, she became pregnant. You know, it's like clockwork, and you could time the birth of the child to the wedding. And I'm just drinking. I'm irresponsible. I'm dropping out of college. So they decide that I'm just not able to provide a safe environment, safe nurturing environment for a family with some type of emotional security, so they leave. I crash a lot of cars, too. I mean, I'm from an era where friends let friends drive drunk. You know what I mean? I don't know about anybody else, but you don't hand over your keys to nobody. That's about the weeniest thing you could possibly do. And so the drunkest person always drove. We would we'd walk to the party, get really drunk, and go back home and get the car. You know, that's just the way it was. So, So I crashed a lot of cars, a lot of fun wrecks. I went through the front windshield once, the passenger windshield. I got thrown out the back window of a car one time. That was fun. I totaled 9 cars in drunken blackouts, 3 DWIs. I walked for practically the entire 80s. Not that I remember much of the 80s, but that was kind of, you know. So, I mean, a lot of things that would get the attention of some alcoholics or some addicts, a lot of things that would get the attention of normal people did not get my attention. So I threw my family in the hat to pay for drinking. All right? Okay, I'll throw the family in that. So I threw, you know, 13 jobs in the hat because I would lose jobs like crazy. That wasn't too high of a price to pay for drinking, you know. So I threw my driver's license into the hat 3 times. You know. But along about 1989, I am drinking about as much as my body can stand of hard liquor. And it's really getting my attention. I am waking up in the morning shattered, you know, I just want to die. And there's no way I can back away from this booze. Every single day I make a decision to never drink again. And by that afternoon, I've got vodka, I've got bourbon, and I'm drinking it again. I was powerless over alcohol. Through one of my, trying to get my license back for a DWI, I went through an outpatient program. And what I learned at that outpatient program, besides I hated Father Martin's guts, besides that, what I learned was that if there was a place, if there was a time and a place where you absolutely had to get sober, you could sign yourself into this rehab. So, the time and the place came, and I signed myself in. I'm going in, and I went into this rehab, and it was. I thought it was a good place at the time, but I've been doing treatment facilities work for about 14 years now. I'm a guest lecturer at Elena Lodge. I do work with UMDMJ. I'm all over the place doing something or other. A lot of times lecturing to would-be alcoholism counselors. You know, the people who go through like 9 years of school and an AA meeting is optional, you know. So anyway, not to digress. Anyway, I look back on this rehab, and this rehab was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. You sat around and did group. Anybody in here ever been in group where you sit in a circle and you talk about your issues and your stuff? Let me tell you, if you're in real trouble, if you're a real alcoholic or a real addict, that's like trying to stop a semi with a cobweb. You know what I'm talking about? If you're in real trouble, you need a little bit more than doing group. So anyway, I go through this 28-day program, and I get out, and I swear to God, there's not a person in the world that wants to separate from booze more than me. I sign myself into the booby hatch, okay? I had them take away all my rights. I had designated smoking areas. They told me what to do. They made me clean up the kitchen, all right? I mean, I had to make my bed. I don't know if anybody else in here, but I hate that stuff. You know what I mean? I never would have been good in the military. But, I mean, I made the ultimate sacrifice and put myself in this place because I was serious about separating from alcohol. I knew it was killing me. I needed to get away from it. So I get out of this place. I got the $13,000 big book and the pat on the butt to AA. And off I went. I'm going to 2 AA meetings a week, 2 outpatient meetings a week, where I paid $35 an hour to drive there at night and to do group. Good God. Anyway, today, you know, I used to tell people things like, you should really persevere with that outpatient. You know, your chances of recovery are better if you complete it than if you don't. I no longer believe that. I think that by getting involved in a very active, very enthusiastic recovery community is about 10 times better than paying $35 to do group. But that's just my own opinion. Anyway, I'm on my way to an AA meeting. It's about 3 months into my sobriety. And I'm on my way to an AA meeting, and the thought crosses my mind that it'd be a good idea to buy a gallon of vodka and drink it. And that's exactly what I did on the way to an AA meeting. that couldn't have been there couldn't have been a crazier thought in my mind. And I justified it in a couple of ways. One way was, it's been a long time since I've been drunk. I don't even know what it's like to be drunk. How can I keep going to AA without remembering what it's like to be drunk? You know, how stupid. I can't do that. And another was, you know, I haven't gotten a sponsor yet. There's a lot of things that they're asking me to do. I haven't quite really clicked with the group yet. I'll bet you if I drink a gallon of vodka, it'll make me feel so bad, I'll rush back to AA and do what they tell me to do. So, in effect, I bought a gallon of vodka to improve my recovery. And in the long run, I think that it helped me because it gave me an absolute 100% assured understanding of what powerlessness means. Powerless is powerless, okay? Powerless does not mean I'm going to keep myself sober by going to a bunch of meetings. Powerless does not mean I can keep myself sober by going to a bunch of meetings and going through the steps. Powerless does not mean I can keep myself sober, go through the steps with a sponsor, do a lot of service work, that'll keep me sober. That's not what powerlessness means. Powerlessness means if I go to meetings consistently, if I work the steps with a sponsor, and then I get involved in service, maybe that'll put me in the atmosphere where God can remove my obsession to drink. And that's what powerlessness is. There's a wonderful line in the book, The 12 and 12, saying, who among us wishes to admit complete defeat? You know, who wants to say that unless an act of providence comes down out of the sky and gives you the whammy, you're dead? Who the hell wants to admit that kind of powerlessness? But I learned it by buying that gallon of vodka. There was not a person in that AA meeting who wanted to stay sober more than me. I know a lot of people that get into A&A have relapsed, have had hard times in maybe AA or NA. I understand that. Has anybody ever told you that you weren't honest, that's why you picked up, that you weren't being honest? Has anybody ever told you that you just didn't want enough? Do you really believe that? I don't. I think anybody that makes the effort to come in to recovery, to try to participate. It's the scariest thing in the world to come into a 12-step group and raise your hand and tell everybody about, you know, honestly about yourself. Who the hell wants to do that? I believe that anybody that wants to do that has a desire to not drink and to not use. The problem is powerlessness. Okay? I do not believe to not drink and not use and go to meetings is a treatment for alcoholism or drug addiction. It's not. That's not a treatment. Back when I first got sober, everything was don't drink, go to meetings. Don't drink even if your butt falls off. No matter what, just don't pick up a drink and you're a winner. I don't believe any of that stuff anymore. I think that yes, we need to make as much of an effort as we possibly can to not drink and not use. But there are periods of time where it's out of our hands. In the second step of Alcoholics Anonymous, which translates over to A&A, it says, come to believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity. I just want to tell you what I've learned about sanity and what I try to explain to alcoholism counselors and people who are in treatment facilities, because it's very, very important to understand this. Sanity is a term that if you follow the root origin, the word origin, it'll trace back to 16th century English law. What happened was, they used to have a lot of laws for a lot of things back then, and they were putting a lot of people away, and they felt bad about it. They were putting the village idiots and the nutcases in prison for long periods of time for doing things that they really weren't responsible for doing. They didn't know right from wrong. They didn't have the capacity to truly understand the ramifications of certain actions. So they came out with an insanity defense so that they wouldn't have to unnecessarily and cruelly punish these people who really didn't know what they were doing. Well, that's where sanity, insanity came from. I believe that once I am told that I need to be consistent with 12-step meetings of my choice, I need to work through the steps with a sponsor or a spiritual advisor and do all of them, and then do the same thing with other people, take other people through the steps and be of service wherever I can be. I believe that once I've been told that that's the treatment for my alcoholism or my drug addiction, it's now my responsibility. But prior to knowing that, it's not. You're not responsible for picking up and using. You're not responsible for drinking. You're not responsible for using. You get put in what the book Alcoholics Anonymous terms is a strange mental blank spot or a subtle form of insanity that precedes the first drink. The first 60 pages of the book Alcoholics Anonymous is devoted to telling you that this happens. They smash home upon the alcoholic reader the fact that powerlessness is powerlessness. Somewhere along the line in Alcoholics Anonymous, I can't really speak for NA, I don't have any experience there, but somewhere along the line in Alcoholics Anonymous, people started to think that it was incumbent upon the individual to keep themselves sober. That's not what our book is about. That's not what the 12 steps are about. The 12 steps are about introducing someone to a set of spiritual exercises that result in a spiritual awakening that places one in an atmosphere whereby one can recover and God can enter in and provide the power to do the things that the individual does not have on their own. All right? This is really what ANA is about. It's about power. It's about finding that power. Somewhere along the line in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know this from other people telling me, somewhere along the line in Narcotics Anonymous, it became okay to allow someone to languish in the back of the room and not hold them responsible for working the 12 steps, which would bring them into recovery. They would allow them to maintain a tenable, very, very tenable sobriety for however long, who knows, a very tentative, very unknown amount of time type of sobriety, and not hold them accountable to work the steps. ANA is about the first decade of AA. It's about doing what they did in the first decade of AA. The first decade of AA, they were running a 50% recovery rate for people that walked through the door. They were running a 75% recovery rate after people relapsed a couple times, coming to the conclusion that they better listen to what they're talking about in AA. And even in Cleveland, Ohio, they claimed a 93% permanent recovery rate for people that went through the steps. Somewhere along the line, it became okay not to do the steps. Then our recovery rates plummeted to who knows what they are now. I was speaking the other night. I said it's about 6%, and somebody took me to task after the meeting about that. Where do you get that statistic? And I go, I don't know. I've just heard it. I mean, statistics in an anonymous fellowship are bogus, really. But I mean, think about it. I've been around a long time, and there's been a lot of people who've come through AA. And let me ask you this. Let's say you've got a group that celebrates 90 days, and four or five people celebrate 90 days. Four or five people should be celebrating 20 years at the same time if you had 100% recovery. But you don't get that. You get maybe one person a year celebrating 20 years. So you know that here's what happens. In the first 5 years of any fellowship, people learn that they're really not alcoholic. They're really not a drug addict. That happens all the time because they discover that they have the power to choose whether they drink or use or not. They've got the power. Alcoholics Anonymous is filled with people like this. So the first time, a boss yells at them, they go to AA and they stay sober the rest of their lives, and they wonder about you fanatics that do the steps and sponsor people, because all they do is go to two meetings a week and, sit there and smile. And they're fine. Okay? These are heavy drinkers. They're not alcoholics. They can keep themselves sober on their own unaided will. However, there are a lot of people who can't. The first 5 years of any fellowship weeds those people out. Most of them. Some of them stay and hang around, but most of them disappear. They find that primetime television is a little more interesting than listening to bummed out Bob share about his new drama, So they'll disappear. But after 5 years, anybody that's been around 5 years is usually an alcoholic or usually a drug addict, or else why would you still be there? Well, half of the people who have over 5 years have less than 10. Half of the people who have over 10 years have less than 15. Half the people who have over 15 years have less than 20. You see what I'm getting at? We lose half the fellowship every 5 years in both NA and AA, at the very least. So our statistics are pretty abysmal. So I think it's important to look at why the statistics were so good in the first decade of AA. What were they doing? Because whatever they were doing, it was working. I'll tell you what they were doing. Before they allowed you into the fellowship, before they allowed you to take a meeting hostage with your drama de jour for 10 minutes in a closed-minded depression meeting, before they allowed you to do that and just dump all your garbage out on the table, they made you go through the steps. You know, there's a couple of books that document this. That's where the back to basics have actually come from. They went back to all the inner groups and they looked over all their records. This guy did a huge history of it, and he found out that they had beginners meetings. They would assign an individual to take the people into another room and get the people through the steps before they were allowed to populate the main meeting. And that way they at least knew one of two things they knew. They knew, number one, that the person is serious, because nobody serious is going to get up to amends. Who the hell wants to go back and make amends to your third grade teacher for like poisoning her apple or something? I mean, who wants to do that stuff? It's humbling. So they know that people that have started on amends are serious. And number two, you get a change in perspective. You start to have a spiritual awakening by the time you get to step nine. And you're not going to blither on about your daily drama. You're going to talk about the excitement of recovery. You're going to talk about how best to help other people. You're going to talk about things not of the self, but unselfish. So that's why they did this in the first decade of AA. You see the parallels with ANA? That's why ANA in the last couple of years has grown to 7 meetings, is it? Counting the commitments, yeah. 7 meetings already. A couple of hundred people. It took AA 4 years to get 80 people. So what's happening in ANA is working. There's an enthusiasm about this group. It's also inclusive. You know, I don't think anybody's going to care what your drug of no choice was. You know what I mean? I don't think anybody's going to have an issue. Because, you know, we don't want those quaalude addicts over there, polluting our straight cocaine meeting. You know, I mean, nobody's going to care in ANA. ANA focuses on recovery. Now, here's what happened in my own personal experience, and here's what led up to me taking a lot of people through the steps, and then led to the formation of some of these groups. I'm a real alcoholic. I'm a stumbling, bumbling, shooting myself in the foot alcoholic. I am the real deal. You can find me in the early chapters of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I got sober and I started hanging out with Radio Shack Mike and a couple other people who were fresh out of rehab, the young people. They were going to all the sober dances. They were doing all kinds of stuff. Now, looking back on it, I know exactly what happened to me. I was a real alcoholic, and I started hanging out with a bunch of heavy drinkers, a bunch of recreational drug users. And they came into AA, and they immediately turned it into their social setting and started doing the social AA things, like socially going to the bars and hanging out, and socially going to the clubs and dancing. And they were dragging me along. Now, I had a sponsor, and many, many sponsors back in 1989, 1990, were not of the type who were going to drag you kicking and screaming through the steps. It was an oral tradition area in North Jersey at that time. What they would do is they would give you wisdom teachings. Well, my sponsor says, you know, underneath every skirt's a slip, Jim. You know, I mean, you know, like wisdom teachings like that. You know, and you'd go like, wow, yeah. Oh, my sponsor's so wise. And meanwhile, you'd relapse like a sumbitch. But anyway, that's the type of sponsorship I was born and bred on. So I'm hanging out with these people who can keep themselves sober. They can keep themselves sober. Plenty fine, thank you. And I'm dying with these people. I am getting sicker and sicker every day, and I'm starting to act as if everything's all right. Chris, is everything all right? Yeah. How are you doing today, Chris? Fine. If I was truthful, I'd say, well, I've got these homicidal, delusional fantasies of killing everybody and then myself. You know, how are you doing today? But I knew that wouldn't go over very well, so I kept my mouth shut. And I am restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontented, I'm suffering from misery and depression and remorse and guilt and anxiety and some sort of fear. And how are you doing? Fine! You know, fine. I'm an untreated alcoholic. If you lit a match around me, I'd go up like a gasoline rag. So, anyway, I'm hanging out with these people who are getting better. They're getting better. They're listening to Louise Hay tapes and doing affirmations, you know. And they made the mistake of giving me a set one time. And then I started listening to it. It said, look in a mirror and say to yourself 100 times, Chris, you're a wonderful guy. So I'm sitting in a mirror. I'm a wonderful guy. Smash the mirror. I'm a jerk. I mean, affirmations don't work on real alcoholics. You know, that's like doing group. Anyway, so I'm dying. One of my friends at that period of time was listening to some tapes, and he tossed me a set of tapes by a couple of guys from Arkansas, Joe and Charlie. Some people in here might have heard of Joe and Charlie. Well, I get these tapes, and I don't like people from Arkansas. Okay? Never met any, but you're from Arkansas, I hate you. You know, stay away from me. I hate people from Texas, too. You know, Oklahoma isn't any better, you know? And so it took me a while to play them, but finally I threw them in the tape deck, and I'll synopsize them in like one sentence. Here's what they said. Chris, you have zero program. What you're doing is you're being active in the fellowship. It's a three-part illness with a three-part treatment. You're in one treatment. It's a threefold disease with threefold treatment. You're in one fold. You're two folds short. You don't have a program because you're not in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. You're not working through the steps with a sponsor. And at the most, you can carry people to the message because you don't have a message because you haven't gone through the steps. You have to go through the steps to have a message. So you may be driving people to the message, but you're not carrying one because all you're doing is sharing your drama de jour, probably. This is what these tapes said to me. I was upset, okay? Because at that period of time, I was going to 7 to 12 meetings a week. I was sponsoring people because, you know, the tugboat with the most steam sometimes gets the boats. And I gave good share, so people would ask me to sponsor, you know. Some of them are even still alive. But I was driving the boobies from the hatch to the meeting. I was a secretary here. I was a no-show GSR there. I mean, I was getting involved, and I was doing what I thought was getting A's in AA. I was doing more than anybody I knew, so I thought I was doing great. And all of a sudden, these guys named Joe and Charlie tell me, You're gonna die. You know, you don't even have an understanding of what recovery is like. You know, when you're in a step meeting, you're sharing an opinion on an experience you've never had. You ever go to a step meeting and somebody raises their hand on the ninth step and says, "Well, I haven't done this step formally." You ever hear that? And then they take the meeting hostage for 10 minutes, sharing their opinion on a step that they haven't taken, but what it might be like if they ever did? You know, that was me, okay? So I'm upset. I listened to these tapes. I threw them on the shelf, you know, these guys. Now I really hate people from Arkansas. I got good reason now. But I'll tell you what, the truth haunts. There's a part in the book that says if we've disturbed you about your alcoholism, this is all to the good. Because what happens is when you get hit with truth, the truth about your nature, your stock in trade, it will do one thing. It will upset you. It will make you very, very angry. But you'll have to come to terms with it somehow. You're going to have to come to terms with it somehow. Most of the really, really important truths I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous made me upset first, pissed me off first. So anyway, my life continues to get worse. I end up hooking up with a woman in AA, and the relationship explodes. It's like, you know, and I get to a point where I have to go back and I have to listen to these tapes again. Because there was something about these tapes, there was something about the message of Alcoholics Anonymous that really captured me. So I got these tapes out, I put them in a tape player, I opened up the book Alcoholics Anonymous and I started through the book. See, where I got sober, there was nobody in my area that had experience working through the book Alcoholics Anonymous. If you were to do the steps, they would tell you to go to a bunch of step meetings. What I found about step meetings is step meetings are where about 80% of the people in the group have never done the steps, but they share about them, they philosophize about them, they read about them, they think about them, and they go to meetings about them. They just don't do them. It would be like going to the airport and hanging out in the terminal night after night after night and never getting on a plane. Just talking about what it would be like to fly. That's what step meetings are like. It's like talking about what it would be like to have a spiritual awakening if I ever decided to ever make some amends. So anyway, that's what it was going on back in 1990 around me. So anyway, I start through the book, and I'm not saying I did a great job doing the steps. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles, especially when you don't have a guide and you're going through it yourself. But what happened was, I was sponsoring a bunch of people who were relapsing on me at this period of time. Ever have somebody relapse on you, make you look bad? You know what I mean? And then people come up to you and you go, "Hey, what the hell's going on with T over there? Don't you sponsor him?" Yeah? And I'll lie. I'll go like, "No, no, he's not mine." You know? But so people were relapsing on me, which was just beyond me being able to tolerate. So I had just gone through this book, and I'd gotten somewhat of a spiritual awakening. I mean, I actually had a list of people to make amends, and I actually started making amends to these people, which was surprised the hell out of people in my home group, I'll tell you, when I started talking about it. Started looking at me like, "You're really doing this stuff? You're in a 12-step program, and you're doing the 12 steps?" So anyway, I started bringing people over to my house, and we'd start on the title page and we'd go through the book line by line, sentence by sentence. And wherever there was an instruction, the individual that I was working with, I would say, "Are you clear on this instruction? You're going to do it. You're fine. T's one of the first victims of this method of sponsorship. That was got to be 11, 12 years ago now, right? A long time ago. Anyway, here's what I found out. I found out something very, very significant. One of the things is that every single person that went through and did a 4-step, did a 5-step, did their amends and stayed consistent with these spiritual exercises, every single one of them is still around, still a member, in good standing, helping other people and sponsoring other people. Their quality of life is through the roof. Every single one. The people that balked on step 4 and step 5, step 8 and step 9, like, "I don't really need to make those amends," allowed their ego to dissuade them from making the amends. Those people, you know, I'm not saying they all drank. A lot of them did. Some of them, you know, most of them just drifted away. They're not around in the meetings anymore. They didn't find something significant enough in the meetings to keep them coming. You ever see, you know, why do people drift away? Why do we lose all the old timers? Why do we lose all the people? Because there's not anything significant holding them in. Go through the steps. Start sponsoring a bunch of people. You're going to have something significant to hold you in the fellowship. You aren't going anywhere if you do that. If you stay on the outskirts, or you want to be an alkanaut and just like orbit the groups and come in for a landing every once in a while, you know, do a touchdown, that's fine. But you're putting your sobriety at risk doing that. You know what I mean? So anyway, all of a sudden, I've got a bunch of guys who went through the steps. Now they're looking for victims. And they start taking other people through the steps. Ray T, a lot of people in my area. There's Ron, there's a bunch of people that are still in AA, you know, that didn't go over to the dark side yet, you know, the A&A. And But they're really active. They're taking a lot of people through the steps. There are literally hundreds of people in my sponsorship line, that have gone through the steps. Now, bring us to our issue about A&A. Again, I'm not here to disparage any other fellowship. I really am not. I know that NA is for a lot of people, and I know AA is for a lot of people. I also know A&A is for a lot of people. The feedback I was getting from some of the guys were their main drug of no choice was usually drugs. That's usually where they ID'd with other people. In the first step, you have to come to terms with your truth about what you're powerless over. It can be booze, it can be drugs, it can be both. You know, it can be tower sniping, it can be too many chocolate cakes. It doesn't matter what you're powerless over, but you got to come to terms with what you're powerless over. You have to admit to it, and you have to understand that you cannot overcome this yourself. All right. So if you're a drug addict, you can't come into AA and say you're an alcoholic night after night after night and start a spiritual program that demands rigorous honesty off with a lie. I'm an alcoholic. No, you're not. You know, come to terms with your own truth, whatever that is. This is one of the reasons for AA. We don't care. I shouldn't say we. These guys don't care what your truth is. You know what I'm saying? So, step 1 and step 12 are very important. You need to understand what you're powerless over, because in step 1 you need to admit to it, and in step 12 you need to help other people with the same problem. I made the mistake and it wasn't too recently either. I mean, I made this mistake of really believing I could significantly help an addict, being an alcoholic myself. I really thought that I could, and I made it. I made a good effort. I sponsored a lot of people who were drug addicts. Usually they got sicker with my help. That's usually what happened. They usually ended up relapsing. Yes, they learned about the recovery process. There were some positive things about going through the steps with me. But there was not a connection. It was always, I'm not like you. I'm on the outside and I'm looking in. So it's very, very important to do your 12-step work with individuals that have the same powerlessness as you. All right. What I was hearing was, in NA, they were trying to carry a big book message. And because NA, like AA, is not affiliated with any outside enterprises, they have a tradition of not really caring to see the book Alcoholics Anonymous on their tables in an NA meeting. I'm not being preferential. I'm sure that if everybody showed up at a step meeting with the NA basic text, there would be some people in the AA step meetings that would have a problem with that. I'm not saying that that's bad. I'm not saying that that's good. I'm just saying that some of the people that I was working with were having trouble identifying with people and having trouble working with other people in the other fellowships, because you can only give away what you have. And if you've gotten your recovery through the big book, through the 12-step process, that's all you can give away. You're not going to make up something. You're going to take them through the way you went through. You're going to share your experience in recovery. And they were getting a hard time sharing their experience in some of the other fellowships because their experience came from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. So there was some prejudice. I'm sure there was some prejudice on the AA side, with the way everything was going too. So there was room in the community for an inclusive fellowship that uses the form of recovery that has been shown to work the best, and that's first decade AA recovery using the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Remember, people got sober for a long time before the step book was ever written, and they got sober for some 30-some years before page 449 was written. It's what made AA from year 4 to year 10 grow from somewhere around 80 people to somewhere around 100,000. And that can happen here. You're at a historic turning point in this fellowship. This fellowship is still in its infancy. It's still maturing. It's an exciting time in this fellowship. You know, jump in here, become part of it. There is something happening here that's special, that's exciting. It's not new. It's just being emphasized. The right things in ANA are being emphasized. I don't think they really care too much how you feel in ANA. I think they certainly care about what you do, because what you do is going to bring you recovery. What you feel is irrelevant. Right, Jim?
Absolutely.
That's right. Anyway, I think I've talked enough. I have no idea what time it is.
You got a few more minutes.
I'm done.
Cool, brother. Thanks a lot.